before the tape came out, before anyone had a chance to gauge objectively its impact on the Senate. Confused and anguished, Ziegler took both the transcript and his doubts to Frank Gannon. "It's not that bad," Gannon concluded. Many of the references seemed to him ambiguous. "It's an early tape, showing early knowledge of White House involvement in the break-in." But it looked to Gannon as if there was a longer word count in the section on legitimate CIA considerations and national security than in the brief section which referred to the political implications of the break-in. 2 weeks is not that long to hold something back, and he did tell Gray within 2 weeks to follow Watergate no matter where it led. The problem, Gannon told Ziegler, was that Nixon was not really focusing on the substance of the tape in considering resignation. He was allowing himself to be swayed by the reactions of his advisors. The real damage of the tape was that it had been held back for 2 years, but it was not the smoking gun, he argued, unless those inside the White House chose needlessly to classify it as a murder weapon. Gannon's argument was not unlike Nixon's explanation to Buzzard earlier that week. To Ziegler, it was convincing. Certainly there was nothing so obvious about the tape's real meaning as to warrant locking the president into resignation at this point. Those who were pushing for resignation were those responsible for the care and keeping of the tapes, as well as for the president's defense. It was understandable. They were on the line, too. Gannon and Ziegler thought they were panicking. Ziegler said the president might go on television Monday, probably to resign, though nothing seemed certain. "The tape failed to merit such a drastic act," Gannon argued. "And if the president were eventually to step down, his reasons should not be that particular conversation." Ziegler was persuaded. Haig stayed alone in his office after Buchanan and the others left. About 9 o'clock, he telephoned his younger brother Frank, a Jesuit priest and professor of nuclear physics at Loyola College in Baltimore. Although the two brothers were close, they had seen each other only once in the last 4 months. Al Haig asked his brother about the health of their 84-year-old mother, who suffered from angina and had recently been hospitalized. The general asked Frank to check in on her. "He wouldn't be able to do it again for a while," he explained, "because things were getting pretty hectic at the White House." Frank thought his brother sounded tense, almost desperate. He knew that Al had been under severe pressure at the White House. Last month on the phone, Frank had asked him if there were any people he could rely on to help him. Haig had mentioned Buzzard as one of the few, but Frank knew that Buzzard's heart attack had reduced his usefulness. Frank thought his brother might want to talk to someone outside the White House now. "It's been a long time since I saw you," Frank said. "We should get together." There was a long pause. Then Al Haig reached for the opening. "How about tomorrow for lunch?" They made arrangements and then talked a while longer about their mother. Frank recalled a recent conversation with her. If only Al had had sense enough to go to law school, he might have made something of himself, she had said. What more could he be? Frank had asked. Al was already the president's chief of staff. He could be senator from Pennsylvania, Mrs. Haig had replied. Since late spring, David and Julie Eisenhower had lived nearly half the time in the White House. They had virtually moved in after the president's return from San Clemente. Their lives were built around Nixon and his defense. Though Watergate was not often discussed, it dominated life in the residence. Nixon had conveyed to them his fear that he would, in the end, lose. Early that afternoon, David had had a long lunch with Bibi Rebozo in the third-floor solarium, a large, informal room with huge picture windows and a broad view of the Washington Monument, the Jefferson Memorial, and the Potomac River. They talked about the mounting Watergate difficulties for both the president and Rebozo. The Senate Watergate Committee's investigation into Rebozo's receipt of $100,000 in cash from billionaire Howard Hughes had led to a full-dress probe of his life and financial dealings. The IRS and the special prosecutor had joined those who were poring over Rebozo's records. His days were spent meeting with lawyers and investigators. But that afternoon, he was more concerned with the president's problems. Rebozo was forlorn. He raised the question of resignation, the pros and cons for the president if he quit voluntarily. Rebozo rarely discussed the situation so openly. To David, that indicated a shift, or a coming shift, in the president's attitude. Was it worth it for Nixon to fight this thing through the Senate? Rebozo asked, and he struggled for the answer. He didn't know. He was trying to review what had happened, think through the sequence of events that had permitted Watergate to swell to such dimensions. There was very little bitterness in his voice, just bewilderment and disgust at the lawyers. For Rebozo, they were the source of much of the difficulty. What was truly amazing, he concluded, was the president's strength, the fact that he was still around after all that had happened. It was a thought that worried David. The president was passive, despondent. For months, David had been waiting for Mr. Nixon to go bananas, as he sometimes phrased it. He and Julie had discussed it. David thought the president might commit suicide. Nixon's political life was his life. Totally. And now it was going. Even Mr. Nixon could see that in his clearer moments. David seemed convinced he would never leave the White House alive. That evening at about 6:30, David was in his comparative law class at George Washington University when a message came to call his wife at once. David left class and went to a phone. "I want you home," Julie said. David said he would be right there. Home meant the White House, and his wife's voice and her tenseness revealed a great deal. David rushed back to class, stuffed his books and papers into his briefcase, and walked 5 blocks to the White House. He concluded that the family was being called together to review another Watergate crisis, as they had been in May and December of 1973. David was used to the drill, listening, weighing options, boosting Mr. Nixon's morale, and finally resolving to fight. When he got to the White House, he went upstairs to see Julie. She had talked with her father. "Daddy says it's all over." David went down the hall to the Lincoln sitting room, where he found the president and Rebozo. As was his custom, the president had not called for anyone to come. When he wished company, he simply made himself available. The president still had his dark blue suit and tie on. The air conditioner was on high, and as usual, a fire was burning in the fireplace. The president sat staring into it, his feet up on an ottoman. It was a moment before he realized that David was in the room.
"It's over," Nixon told his son-in-law. "We've got to decide by Monday night whether to get out of here."
Then his voice trailed off. He continued to gaze into the fire. "Why is it over?" David asked.
"There was a new tape," the president replied. "The question of whether to fight or to resign had to be decided by Monday, because the transcript would be released then. Remarks are being drafted for Monday night," he added. He didn't say what the remarks would be about.
Nixon picked up the phone and called Haig. He wanted the transcript sent up. The president turned to David. "The transcript would explain the situation," he said, despondently. As they waited, Nixon told him Buzzard judged the situation hopeless. Fred had been saying it was over since the day of the Supreme Court decision, the president said. "And St. Clair?"
"St. Clair is upset," the president answered,
without further explanation. He seemed irritated with his lawyers. They wanted to give up before he was ready. When the transcript arrived, David took it to another room. Julie joined him. Rebozo, Tricia Cox, and Mrs. Nixon moved in and out of the Lincoln sitting room, almost in shifts. As he read the transcript now, David was convinced it was over, either by impeachment or by resignation. Julie did not express disagreement, though she was not ready to agree either. They went back to the Lincoln sitting room, and David went to the president's side.
"It's been my feeling that we're not as innocent as we said,
or as guilty as they said," David said. Nixon did not react.
he kept looking into the fire. They were all familiar with his tendency to let conversations go on around him. The president had shared his office with the family. He always included them. They were there when decisions were made. Now they were trying, as a family, to come to grips with impeachment or resignation. They searched for a frame of reference, some way to put into context what was happening to them. Was it like being on the losing side on election eve? Or like Charles I, were they being beheaded? Or are we the Romanovs? David wondered aloud. The secret to making a point in the Nixon family had always been to start with an accepted premise and then to offer distinctions. The premise that had been established this evening was that Watergate, whatever its significance, was an injustice, a small matter, which, in fairness, should not cost Nixon the presidency. But it was the president himself who pointed out the hard realities. Impeachment was now a certainty, he said, and removal by the Senate a probability. The family had to be prepared for that. Then he lapsed into silence. David, sitting with his back to the fireplace, could see the flames reflected in Nixon's glazed eyes. The president looked sad and broken. David had never seen him look so bad. The phone rang and Nixon picked it up. The conversation was brief.
"I wish you hadn't said that," the president said,
and turned around to report that Haig had just told him Buchanan's reaction.
"Pat thinks it's fatal," the president reported. "He reacted the way I expected he would."
And he stared once again into the fire. Julie was particularly concerned that her father's hand not be forced by defections. Her lines to the staff were excellent, and that afternoon she had received several calls reporting that some members were deserting the president. "There was no question that the staff was dispirited," the president said. "Defections had to be expected once the transcript became public." "And the cabinet? Would they hold?" Nixon shook his head slowly. The best assessment was that 6 cabinet members would resign if he tried to cling to office through a Senate fight. David was certain that his father-in-law had no basis for such a prediction, and that he was driving home the gloom as hard as possible. The drift of his conversation seemed to be that the family should prepare itself for resignation, though that was still up in the air as far as he was concerned. Whatever happened, they would all need to summon extraordinary strength for the days ahead, he said. About 9 o'clock, Ed Cox arrived and was given the transcript to read. "The tape," he said, "is not that conclusive." Cox's approach was calm and lawyerly. "Don't hurry," he advised. He sounded almost optimistic at times as the talk moved back and forth from one family member to another. They were all aware that, in his way, the president was seeking their assessments. Julie stressed again and again her fear that her father would wake up some morning regretting it if he didn't see it through. There was no need to resign yet. Besides, the transcript hadn't even been released. Even if it meant conviction, she added, the right course might be to fight through a Senate trial. David thought this fireside conversation was the death knell. Yet, largely out of consideration for Julie and her father, he softened his judgment, painted a brighter picture than he saw. The transcript represented only part of the story, he suggested. Mr. Nixon should not be swayed by its probable effect, only by what he thought was the right thing to do. And whatever he chose to do, David added, they would all support him. He had come up with brilliant strokes before. There was always a chance he could do it again, even now. Rebozo offered no opinions. He simply repeated what others said. He looked stricken and tired. Mrs. Nixon said very little. The others were extremely solicitous of her feelings, sensitive to the fact that she had never been very happy, certainly not during her time in Washington. Whenever anyone raised the possibility that the president could survive the tape, Nixon tensed. "It was over," he insisted. He seemed fearful that the others were bending backward to be considerate because they thought the tape was so damning. Their reactions
seemed only to intensify his pain.
No, he repeated. They all had to see that it was the end.
To David, it was only a question of whether there would be a quick execution or whether they would be like the survivors in the novel On the Beach, waiting grimly for an end they knew must come. Part of Nixon wanted to fight, to pull them all through, to save them. Quitting would be interpreted as a blanket admission of guilt, he said, an acknowledgement of all that his enemies had accused him of, all they said about us. He wouldn't have that. The immediate question was what they, the Congress and the press, would do with the transcript. Perhaps there was still a way to prevail, to make the best speech of my life, but he seemed to reject the prospect even as he mentioned it. Normally Nixon followed a conversation carefully with his eyes, back and forth, boring in on whoever was talking or being addressed. Not this night. David thought Mr. Nixon seemed almost tranquilized. He talked quietly, leaving sentences and thoughts unfinished, avoiding all eyes. As it grew late, his manner became more disjointed, and he seemed on the verge of coming apart. The president started reminiscing. It was the most difficult moment of all, a signal that he was capitulating. He talked about their early days in the White House, the foreign policy initiatives, Trisha's wedding, the White House itself, its history, its comforts, the friends, the staff, the parties. One memory unlocked the next. But there was no mention of anything since June 17, 1972. Not even the triumph of the re-election victory. It was nearly midnight when the conversation finally stopped of its own weight. The question was unresolved, at least in any explicit way.
I am deferring any decision for now, Nixon finally said. We'll get together in the morning and decide this.
He picked up the phone by his side and called Haig.
Nothing had been decided, he said.
The others left, and Richard Nixon was alone by the fire again. In the Eisenhower's bedroom, Julie called Buchanan's house. Shelley Buchanan roused her husband, who was half asleep after a number of martinis at the Moon Palace, and told him that Julie was on the phone. Buchanan knew why she was calling. He said it could wait until the morning. Shelley told Julie that Pat was asleep. For Julie and David, the response was answer enough. Even Buchanan was in the resignation camp.
Saturday, August 3rd. Buchanan arrived at his office shortly before 9:30 on Saturday and returned Julie's call. Come on over, she said. He took his time. Rushing right over would only contribute to the crisis atmosphere, and it was going to be a difficult enough encounter. Buchanan, like Rebozo, was treated as a member of the family. Except for his wife, Shelley, and Woods, he had been with Nixon longer than anyone else on the staff. No aide was as important psychologically to the president. The two men shared the same political instincts. Now Buchanan was about to recommend to the president's family that Richard Nixon resign from office. After a half hour, he walked across West Executive Avenue and took the elevator upstairs to the solarium. They were drinking coffee when he arrived. Julie, David, Tricia, Ed, Rebozo. There was no brushing over things. Quickly, Julie outlined what she called the family position. They were against resignation, even if it meant conviction by the Senate. Daddy's not a quitter, she reminded Buchanan. It would be better for Daddy if he laid it all out before the country. He would have a forum to show what a trivial matter they are taking away his presidency for. He could stress his accomplishments against this smaller, less significant thing. And, she added, there was always the possibility, no matter how remote, that he could prevail in the Senate. He wants to fight it out, Pat. Buchanan sipped his coffee. That morning her father had complained that the staff was giving up before he was ready, she said. And she knew, from her own phone calls, that the morale of the staff was in danger of collapse. Buchanan understood. If the president were deserted by his staff, even the dignity of fighting to the finish would be taken from him.
The president could persevere only if the staff remained loyal. Buchanan shifted uneasily. References to staff defections were disconcerting, and he wanted to avoid a discussion of who might hold and who might desert. Bitterness between the family and the president's aides was the last thing anyone needed now. "If the president decides to fight this out in the Senate, I'll be with him," Buchanan reassured them gently. "I'm not going to hit the silk, but there's no chance of winning in the Senate. If he stays, it's only a short matter of time before even his closest friends start deserting him. First the Chowder and Marching Society, then the party, then some of the staff. People are going to be demanding his resignation. The party will have a terrible defeat in November if he doesn't resign." Buchanan was swallowing hard. "Hell, I understand why he wants to stay on. But he'd be blackened, Julie. It's a straight road downhill. For him, for the conservative cause, and for the country. There comes a time when you have to say, it's finished, it's over. Nothing would be served by dredging it down through the Senate, not for any of us." It wasn't easy to say. "But we're old buddies," he reminded them. David was impressed by Buchanan's arguments. He began to refashion them in his own words, but his wife interrupted him. "David," Julie snapped, "Pat's already been over that. We know your view." The conversation turned once again to the White House staff. The family wanted to know why certain key members were so strong for resignation.
"Are they responding to the tape itself? Or other things?" Ed Cox asked.
"They're being realistic," Buchanan replied. "Look at the Wiggins thing. Judiciary's gone already."
They didn't know about Wiggins. Buchanan told them about the congressman's visit and his reaction to the transcript. "But the tape's not that conclusive," Cox asserted. His approach was prosecutorial, not antagonistic, but probing.
There was enough ambiguity about the tape, Cox insisted, to at least think about trying to redeem the situation. Buchanan paused, searching for the right words. This was the hardest part. "The problem is not Watergate or the cover-up," he began. "It's that he hasn't been telling the truth to the American people." He paused again. "The tape makes it evident that he hasn't leveled with the country for probably 18 months. And the president can't lead a country he has deliberately misled for a year and a half."
Rebozo broke the silence. He was smiling slightly. "The president thought you'd come down on the resignation side," he told Buchanan. His tone was friendly. "Pat was just being realistic and open-minded," David suggested. Julie flashed a menacing look at David. Rebozo resumed quickly. "Pat, this is a great man we're talking about. He's never walked away from a fight, and he's done great things for the country. He wanted to know how the tape demonstrated that the president had lied for 18 months. It sounded to him as if the president had been saying the same thing all along. He was innocent. How could an innocent man resign the presidency of the United States?" Buchanan tried again. He explained the background of the May 22nd statement. "Price and I raised the question then. We sent Fred back to ask him. At that time, there was knowledge on the president's part that the tapes were there. It would have been a simple matter to check." David was impatient. Last night's discussion, now this one, and he could see the same conversation continuing for weeks. "They would all do well to consider the implications of what Pat was telling them," he said, "especially about the damage to the party, the country, and Mr. Nixon if he tried to fight his way out." Julie flared. "We've heard from Pat already, okay, David? You don't have to tell us again." David realized that he was doing a lot of repeating. He was talking as much as Buchanan. Ed appeared irritated with him, too. Cox resumed his cross-examination. "Why did there necessarily have to be a big defeat for the party in November? What were the figures? How many seats would be lost? Why did there have to be a decision on resignation right away? How many members of the staff would leave?" Buchanan was impressed with Cox, with his forcefulness, his intelligence, and his insistence on dealing from facts, not emotions.
He was somewhat surprised. He couldn't remember who had dubbed Ed the Prince, but Buchanan had done his part to see that the name stuck. That, and Cox's other nickname, Fast Eddie. Buchanan was a city kid who had grown up in the streets. His perception of Cox had always been of a brat who had earned the calluses on his hand playing tennis at the country club. His opinion was changing as Cox pressed the argument. Why should the president resign before testing political and public reaction to the transcript? What harm was there in waiting until the tape hit? Buchanan had been thinking along the same lines. He knew what the public and political reaction would be. And when the president, when even Julie, saw the reaction, they would see the wisdom of resignation, for Nixon's own sake. "Maybe the reaction won't be as bad as you think," Julie said. "Why not give it a while? A couple of weeks." Buchanan was agreeable. It would be better for the president to be convinced by events than to be swayed by the judgments of his own staff. The visit, which had lasted more than an hour, ended with both sides feeling that something had been accomplished. Buchanan recognized that the family solidarity claimed by Julie did not exist. Rebozo was confused. Cox was trying to be realistic. Tricia was silent. And obviously, David thought resignation the wisest move. On the way back to his office, Buchanan stopped in to see Rose Woods. Their affection for each other was profound. The White House Irish, bound by temperament, unswerving loyalty to Richard Nixon, and, probably more than any of the others, an understanding of the man. Woods was anguished. Her eyes puffy and red, her voice was tremulous. "How's the old man holding up?" Buchanan asked. She was having too much trouble holding herself together to deal with the question. Woods had never had many illusions about Watergate, especially since the spring of 1973. She and Buchanan had discussed it more than a few times, always careful to avoid specifics. "Rose, he's really screwing this up, and you and I know it," Buchanan had said on one such occasion. "He's up to his ass in this." And Rose had nodded, an expression of helplessness on her face that said, "But what can anyone do?" There had even been fleeting moments when Woods had thought the president would be better off if he resigned. More than anyone else, she could see what it was doing to him. It would be better to escape with what honor was left him than to be crushed and humiliated in the end. But, like Buchanan, she knew that Nixon was determined to persevere, and she too believed passionately that he was a victim of his enemies. The last 9 months in the White House had been excruciating for her. Her bitterness at Garment, once a close friend, Buzzard, and Haig, had intensified since the episode of the 18-and-a-half-minute gap. She felt ridiculed, both by the press and by the members of the staff, who found her testimony hilariously unconvincing. Privately, Buchanan had told others, "Rose knows she erased a good part of it. She was protecting him. I've never asked her, and she's never told me what happened. It's not hard to figure. After Rose had erased the first part, the old man would say, 'Oh, my goodness, Rose, somebody left the tape on.' And at this point, in telling the story, Buchanan would imitate Nixon closing his eyes and pushing the button that erased the rest of the 18-and-a-half minutes. Buchanan's theory was that Nixon gave the tape to Woods because she would know what to do with it. Either Nixon said something like, 'See what you think we should do with this, Rose,' or she knew what to do without being told. When he got to the part about the president closing his eyes, Buchanan would laugh uproariously." On this particular Saturday morning, Buchanan and the president's secretary did not debate the issue of resignation. Each knew where the other stood. Woods was adamantly opposed. The time for resignation had long since passed. The damage was done. He should go down fighting. Let everyone see what they were doing to a great president. Rebozo joined Buchanan as he left Woods' office, and the two walked down the corridor to see Haig. Buchanan wanted to brief the chief of staff on his meeting with the family, but Haig had someone with him. "Why don't we go talk to him?" Rebozo asked. They crossed West Executive Avenue again and entered the reception area of the president's EOB office.
Tell him we're here, Rebozo said to Manolo Sanchez. When there was still no response from the president after several minutes, Buchanan went back to his office. Ziegler entered, a few steps behind him. The decision is to fight it through the Senate, he announced. Buchanan exploded. This was exactly what must be avoided. The president was locking himself into a ruinous position. Ziegler, batted back and forth like a shuttlecock between the forces of fight and flight, was taking no position now. He would go along with whatever the president wanted. After Ziegler left, Buchanan picked up the phone and had the White House operator connect him with Julie. They discussed the president's latest decision very briefly. "We'll support Father down the line. David, too," she told him. David came to the phone and confirmed Julie's statement.
"Okay," Buchanan replied. "That's the decision. Let's support him."
He was less than enthusiastic about the prospect. Buchanan ate a hurried lunch in the senior staff mess and then went to Buzzard's office. St. Clair was there.
"The president's going to fight this thing down to the finish," St. Clair said.
"We're going to show the country just what it means to impeach the president of the United States and convict him." Buchanan was appalled. For the first time in his political life, he was the dove.
He looked at Buzzard. Buzzard indicated that he, too, was going along with the decision, although he lacked St. Clair's zeal. "Do you know what we're getting into?" Buchanan asked him incredulously. He repeated much of the same argument he had made to the family. Buzzard agreed with Buchanan. He was willing to go along with the decision, he explained, because he was certain it would not be final. The never-nevers always seemed to change, he observed, and there was no compelling reason to think that events wouldn't force the president into another 180-degree turn. The danger from St. Clair, Buchanan felt, was not his willingness to defend the president. It was that, in his enthusiasm to do so, he would help push the president into a public statement on Monday that they would all regret. "Let Nixon defend the meaning of the tapes," Buchanan argued, "but don't encourage him to swear to remain in office until every vote is counted in the Senate." Buzzard didn't say much. He was disgusted. He thought St. Clair was merely trying to fortify himself for arguing a hopeless case. St. Clair had been up and down on this all week, Buzzard was thinking. Right now, he was on his upcycle. He would come down again. After 15 minutes of fruitless argument, Buchanan returned to his office and called Haig. The two got along well. Buchanan had spent more time with Haig in 15 months than he had with Haldeman in over 4 years. Haig made himself accessible. Buchanan knew he could always call him and say, "What the hell are you doing this for?" And Haig would say, "Come on over and we'll talk about it." That's what happened now. Buchanan didn't pause for pleasantries when he entered the general's office. "Al, I don't think there's an appreciation around here of what the hell this decision means. If the president takes this to an Alamo finish, I don't think he realizes the impact on himself, the party, the country, his place in history, everything. Our job has to be to keep him from doing something like what Agnew did, something he'll regret later." Up until the day that Vice President Agnew resigned his office, he insisted vehemently that he would not quit. "There's no reason to lock himself into a position. That tape is going to undo him. Events will do the job." Haig agreed. He thought the family was pushing the president toward an irrevocable position. St. Clair's zeal worried him, too. He had long thought that St. Clair's judgments, particularly his political ones, were unrealistic. "Some people aren't realizing the implications of what they're saying and doing," Buchanan stressed. "You're right on that," Haig replied.
St. Clair's deputy, McCahill, had not been able to track his boss down for several days. When St. Clair finally stopped by McCahill's office that afternoon, the deputy had some questions. "How's it going? What's on those tapes?"
"Some interesting things," St. Clair responded.
"How interesting?"
"Very interesting," St. Clair said, and he walked off.
Robert Griffin hadn't slept well Friday night. He rose early on Saturday and paced back and forth in his study, weighing what he might say in a letter to Nixon.
By 8:30 a.m. he was sketching notes on a yellow legal pad. As he worked, he discussed the language with his wife. He wrote and rewrote the letter, withholding the fact that he knew about new evidence, but trying to drive home the prospect of almost certain conviction in the Senate. It took him 4 drafts before he was satisfied. Late that morning, he reached the vice president through the White House switchboard. Ford was campaigning for House candidates in Mississippi and Louisiana that day. He was omitting references to impeachment from his speeches. When pressed by the reporters, who had taken note of the omission, Ford declared that he thought the president was innocent of any impeachable offense. Ford listened as Griffin read him the text of his letter. "Dear Mr. President, there is no doubt in my mind that, unless you choose to resign, the House of Representatives will adopt articles of impeachment, making necessary a trial in the Senate. The Senate would issue a subpoena for the tapes. If you defy such a subpoena, I shall regard that as an impeachable offense and shall vote accordingly." It was a big step for a Republican loyalist. Griffin wondered whether Ford would advise him to go ahead or would say, "No, don't do it." Ford merely said thank you. Griffin told him he knew about a new and damaging tape. Ford's reply was vague, but Griffin took away the impression that the vice president was aware of the new evidence. Shortly before noon, Griffin dictated the letter to his press secretary and instructed him to have it delivered to the White House right away. Griffin wanted the letter to have maximum impact. It should be released to the press, but to avoid any suggestion of grandstanding, it would be given to the Michigan papers only. The wires would pick it up fast enough. Griffin's letter was en route to the White House when Frank Haig arrived to pick up his brother for a late lunch. They went downstairs to the senior staff dining room and took a corner table. Al Haig seemed greatly relieved today compared to the night before. He seemed to be in charge again, to have the situation under control. They talked first about their mother's health. Ziegler stopped by their table to ask Haig whether they should set up a meeting that afternoon between St. Clair and the president. Haig thought it was a good idea. After dessert, Haig introduced his brother to St. Clair and his wife, who were seated at a nearby table. St. Clair was out of sorts and didn't want to chat, so the brothers went back up to the general's office. Frank Haig sat while his brother paced around the room, describing in general terms what was going on. To the annoyance of Muriel Hartley, Ziegler kept walking in and out, ostensibly to deliver various messages. "Why doesn't he mind his own business?" Hartley complained to Judy Johnson. Frank Haig complimented his brother on how well he had handled the television interview with Mike Wallace the previous Sunday. "It's an interesting problem," Haig said. "How do you play the game when you don't have any cards?" Shortly afterward, Haig received word that the president wanted to see him. Griffin's letter had arrived. When Haig came in, Nixon was in a fury. Such threats only solidified his resolve to fight to the end. It was a cowardly letter. He raged about it at some length. Haig did not mention his call to Griffin the day before. The general knew very well that it had triggered the letter. He listened as the president railed about weak-hearted legislators. Finally, Nixon calmed down. At 5:13, the family followed the president up the helicopter ramp for the trip to Camp David. David thought the Griffin letter must have been a fierce jolt. The president looked awful. To complete his cover, Haig told Buzzard that it was probably Ford who had tipped his old friend Griffin. "No one in the White House felt close enough to Griffin," Haig said. At dinner with the family that evening, the president repeated his decision to stay on. At the least, he would give that route a try. He wanted to keep his options open, he told them. And then he polled the family once more. Ed thought it was the right move. There was no reason to be stampeded. Julie was content with the decision. Mrs. Nixon, Tricia, and David said very little, either for or against. David was pretty sure resignation was the only way. He thought the president was unconvincing. "What's your reaction?" Nixon continued to ask around the table. The answers were vague. "What would be your reaction if we had 10 senators? He asked. "If so, would it be worth staying?" David felt sad. 10 senators? He thought to himself.
they had been reduced to 10 senators? That meant 90 against. "Think of yourself," he said.
"Well, David, you're just like Al," the president responded. Haig, too, seemed to be saying, "Think of yourself instead of the country."
If Mr. Nixon thought of the country, David knew the answer would be to fight it out. His father-in-law was utterly convinced that his country needed him. By telling him to think of himself, David was trying to soothe him, trying to say, "You can now contemplate resignation. You deserve it." It was a way to tell a proud man he could, one time at least, walk away from his opponents. The sun was setting. Nixon gazed out the window. The swimming pool was on the right, the putting green directly in front of him. The whole valley stretched out below. He pointed to the putting green and said how much he liked it, how much he would miss it. But he was going to fight it out. Then, abruptly, he left the table and did not come back to join the family for the evening's movie. Jan Barbieri and Ann Greer had arrived in their office prepared for a hectic day. There had been a great deal of talk on Friday about preparing a defense strategy, and word had gone out that all personnel should be available to work through the weekend. Normally on Saturdays, the White House was busy by 9 a.m., with members of the staff trying to catch up on things they had put off all week. This Saturday morning was languid. There didn't appear to be any activity anywhere. Greer and Barbieri began looking for signals to explain the calm, calling back and forth on the phone to report their findings. Aware that Gergen was researching material for the president's defense, Barbieri asked him if she should come in on Sunday.
"No," said Gergen, "and no one is looking for the materials anyway."
He didn't know exactly what was going on either, but the lights were out in many of the offices. Then Barbieri and Greer learned that the 2 p.m. strategy group meeting had been canceled. The whole family and Rebozo were going to Camp David. But Ray Price and his secretary, Margaret Foote, were in. That was unusual. It meant that something big was going to happen. Sometime during the day, Greer asked Diane Sawyer, "Is the president thinking about resignation?" She expected to hear a firm no, but Sawyer said, "Wouldn't you be thinking about it?" Barbieri saw Ziegler walking upstairs in the EOB. He was dragging, and it was only midday. Ziegler's energy usually increased under stress. Later in the afternoon, Greer asked Tom DeCare if he thought Nixon would resign. He said, I don't know. They decided to see if Price was still there. DeCare phoned and Foote answered. DeCare said, "Sorry, wrong number." When Greer and Barbieri left the White House at 7 p.m., Price and Foote were still in the office. Pat Buchanan left the White House about 5 o'clock that Saturday, angry and frustrated. He had finished 5 beers and was starting a 6th when Price called him at home later. Price was upset, too. Haig had told him the president was going to tough it out. Now Price was writing a non-resignation speech, which attempted to gloss over the implications of the June 23rd tape. Nixon would deliver it on television Monday night. Price thought it would be disastrous if the president announced to the nation that, in spite of evidence that confirmed 2 years of lying and subterfuge, he intended to fight to the finish. Price said he was concerned about the attitudes of some people he had spoken to, particularly the lawyers. Some middle ground had to be found to keep the president from irreversible action. They decided to meet in Buchanan's office first thing in the morning. Around 10 o'clock that evening, David and Julie decided to go back to Washington. Camp David had become very depressing. There was little they could do there to improve the situation. The family session the president promised hadn't really taken place. There had been no meaningful attempt to grasp the problem or discuss what must be done, and it didn't look as if it was going to happen. David tried to get some studying done after they got back to Washington, but he found it impossible to focus on law that night. He gave up the effort just before midnight and called his friend Brooks Harrington. He needed to talk to someone. The rest of the family was opposed to resignation, David sadly reported. Since Friday night, the president had been unable to look him in the eye. The big problem, he said, was that Mr. Nixon feared losing their respect if he resigned. So now they had to convince him they would continue to love him, whatever came. David sounded tense and tired. Harrington searched for something to say to comfort him. The Harringtons had been to Mass that evening.
"Carol and I lit a candle for you," Brooks said. David choked and wept.
Sunday, August 4th. The evidence that the president had chosen a disastrous course was in the speech that Price brought to Buchanan's office at 9 o'clock in the morning. It confirmed Buchanan's worst fears. What had started as a speech of resignation was now a statement of defiance. The president intended to tell the nation that nothing save conviction by the Senate would cause him to leave the office to which he had been elected. Buchanan shook his head as he read,
"Though I have lost my base of political support, I will fight for the principle. I will appear in the Senate in person and will carry this struggle to the final conclusion."
The president was committing himself to final devastation, Buchanan told Price. He can't box himself in like that.
Price did not need convincing, he reminded Buchanan. He was only doing his job, following instructions.
They agreed that Buchanan should write a memo to Haig, and they drafted it together. It was directed to the immediate problem, keeping the president from making a public vow to fight to the finish. The president shouldn't lock himself into a pledge to appear before the Senate. There was absolutely no gain in that, they wrote. Nor should he go on television on Monday night. If Nixon couldn't be dissuaded from appearing before the cameras, he should limit himself to a 3-minute filmed statement in the press room in which he merely laid out the contents of the June 23rd tape. Buchanan scrawled a draft of the final paragraph on a notepad. Don't lock him into any statement going all the way. We've been unable to convince him to resign, but events will. Drop the tape and let the tape and the consequences convince him of what we can't. Then he and Price made a few language changes and dictated the memo to Margaret Foote.
It's for the old man's sake, Buchanan told Price. For the future, it would be a terrible thing if we were to talk him into something he doesn't think he ought to do. For the rest of his life, he would say, I was talked into it by advisors, and I could have made it.
We should step back and let the thing blow. The president should feel the force of the blast himself. Let him see reality himself. Price left to get ready to go to Camp David that afternoon. Buchanan was not scheduled to go, but now he wanted to be there. He called Haig's office to tell the general that he was available if wanted. While he waited for Haig's call, Buchanan changed into a pair of jogging trunks. Haig's office called just as he had laced up his new blue and white track shoes. Buchanan would go to Camp David. He phoned Shelley and asked her to bring a jacket and tie to the office. Then he went out of the EOB through the basement, only a few feet from the office where Howard Hunt and the plumbers had worked, and jogged down 17th Street to Constitution Avenue, west to the Lincoln Memorial, east on Independence Avenue to the Jefferson Memorial. He jogged past the Washington Monument, onto the Ellipse, with its view of the White House South Portico. He slowed down only at the guard post on West Executive Avenue between the White House and the EOB as he went back through the Iron Gates. This Sunday's secretarial shift in Haig's office had been drawn by Diana Gwynn, assistant to Staff Secretary Jerry Jones. Wardell, Haig's aide, had asked her to sit in the outer office and answer the phones. Gwynn thought the general looked unusually strained when he and Jewel Wan arrived at 9:30. Haig fussed and fretted over one more problem, the weather. It was raining, making it doubtful that they could helicopter to Camp David. Wardell made alternate plans to drive. He knew the real source of Haig's agitation. On Wednesday, Haig had told him about the tape. "I'm not sure I can justify my actions," the general had said. Gwynn asked Wardell what was going on.
"Just wait," he replied.
"The shit is going to hit the fan. There's a damaging tape coming out tomorrow." Gwynn and Wardell began calling it the killer tape.
As the noon hour approached, the weather broke. The passengers were hurriedly assembled for the drive to the Pentagon helipad. Ziegler, Pat and Shelley Buchanan, Price, Jewel Wan, St. Clair and his wife, Haig and his wife. Climbing into the limousine, Haig looked up at the bright sky and threw a disgusted look at Wardell before shutting the door. Ziegler and the speechwriters shared the second car. Buchanan handed Ziegler a copy of the memo and said that Price was in agreement. Glumly, Ziegler nodded his assent to each of the points up to the final one, that resignation was inevitable. "I agree with the whole thing except the last paragraph," he said. Buchanan was used to Ziegler's habit of never revealing whether his words reflected his own thoughts or the president's. At least, he was now on board against a public pledge to fight it out. Inside the helicopter, Buchanan handed the memo to Haig. Haig read it quickly. The two-step strategy, releasing the tape and then letting events convince the president, appealed to Haig. "I agree with you," he said, passing the page back over his shoulder to Buchanan. Buchanan gave it to St. Clair, seated beside him. He hoped that the wait-and-see approach would appeal to the lawyer's natural caution and dampen some of St. Clair's recent enthusiasm for a Senate battle. St. Clair, however, made another of his sharp turns. He rejected the recommendations and proceeded to outline his latest position. "He's got to resign tomorrow." Those who counseled otherwise were no longer serving the interests of the nation. They all argued with him, shouting to be heard over the noise of the helicopter's engines. When they arrived at Camp David, Haig went immediately to Aspen Cabin to join the president. Buchanan, Price, St. Clair, and Ziegler went to Birch Cabin and resumed their rancorous discussion. As the argument grew more heated, Buchanan concluded that St. Clair's latest turnabout was based largely on a personal concern for his professional reputation. Ziegler was terribly excited. Resignation the next day was out of the question. An attempt to force the president's hand would fail and might even end in disaster. The president, he said, was not convinced that the June 23rd tape was fatal. Buchanan believed that the way to Nixon was through Ziegler, and he wanted to maneuver himself into a more moderate position between St. Clair's resignation now and those willing to fight. To this end, he stepped up his attack on St. Clair. "Drop the tape and he'll come around in a week or 10 days, and the country will be a hell of a lot better off that way." The country would need time for the tape to sink in and bring most people around to the same conclusion Nixon would have to reach. Resignation would be inevitable. St. Clair was not convinced. "How much punishment can one person take? How much can the country take? We're not serving the president if we let him go through with this." "But Jim, I told him to resign three ways," Buchanan said. "Through Al, Beebe, and the family." In half an hour, Haig came back from Aspen. "Al, did the message get through?" Buchanan asked. "Does the president know where I stand?" "Yes," Haig replied. Buchanan turned to St. Clair with a look that said, "You see?" St. Clair started to argue, but Haig cut him off. The president had agreed to scuttle the televised address in favor of a written statement that would be issued the next day along with the transcript. Ziegler went to see the president, and the discussion in Birch Cabin now turned to the written statement. Price went off to work on it. It didn't take him long to figure out what to do. One section of the discarded address was an explanation of the tape. Price picked up his scissors, cut that section out, and redid it more vaguely. The statement would mention neither resignation nor any all-out last-ditch fight. As Price worked, Haig, St. Clair, and Buchanan continued to argue. Telling the president what to do, Haig reminded St. Clair, might trigger the same reaction Griffin's letter had set off the day before, make the man more stubborn. With Haig applying pressure, St. Clair retreated. Haig and St. Clair would brief the loyalists on the committee Monday, but that still left John Rhodes out in the open. Rhodes had scheduled a press conference for Monday, and he had assured the White House that he would direct the anti-impeachment forces in the House debate. "You can't keep the guy out on a hook like that," Buchanan said. Haig went to call Rhodes. "There are some developments that I can't talk to you about," he told him, "but I would advise you very strongly to cancel your press conference." Rhodes thought he had never heard anyone so downhearted. "When will I know what this is all about?" he asked gently. "You'll know tomorrow," Haig replied. "I will have you briefed." Rhodes thanked the general and called Jay Smith, his press aide. He told Smith to cancel the conference.
I think it might be resignation, he said.
The entourage came together shortly after 2 for lunch in the Laurel Lodge. The president had insisted that some of the wives come to Camp David that Sunday afternoon, and Patricia Haig and Billy St. Clair had spent the past few hours picking wild strawberries. There was almost a picnic atmosphere, and their husbands were determined that, during lunch at least, it stay that way. Prime minute steaks, a frequent item on the Camp David menu, were served with fresh vegetables. The conversation was purposefully light. After the stewards had served apple pie a la mode and coffee, the men moved to the cabinet room in Laurel and went over Price's work. He had outlined the basic elements of the next day's statement. 1. While reviewing tapes to be turned over in compliance with the Supreme Court decision, the president discovered a serious omission in his previous statements about Watergate. 2. His review disclosed that, on June 23, 1972, he ordered the FBI's investigation to stop not only for national security reasons, but for political reasons as well. 3. Therefore, complete transcripts of the June 23 conversations were being supplied to the House Judiciary Committee, which had conducted its deliberations on the basis of incomplete and erroneous information. 4. A House vote of impeachment was foregone. Therefore, the issue would go to trial in the Senate. To ensure that no more relevant information was overlooked, the President would voluntarily furnish the Senate with all material that had been turned over to the special prosecutor. 5. While recognizing the damage done his case by this disclosure, the President remained convinced that the record in its entirety did not justify the extreme step of impeachment and conviction of a President. Whatever mistakes he had made in his handling of Watergate, the basic truth remained that, when all the facts were brought to his attention, he insisted on a thorough investigation and prosecution of the guilty. Price was pleased with his draft and thought it expressed his deep belief that the president's actions 6 days after the Watergate break-in were innocent in intent and that nothing Nixon had done merited impeachment. Buchanan was satisfied that the president was not committing himself to wage all-out war. Whatever words Price chose to soften the harsh facts, Buchanan thought there could be no mistaking the impact such a statement would have. It did, however, leave the president a little room. Haig was not satisfied. It wasn't accurate, for one. It implied that Nixon hadn't listened to the tape until after the Supreme Court decision. The fact was that he had heard it sometime during May. Price and Buchanan were confused. Why had he listened to it in May? Haig explained. The president was, at that time, responding to Jaworski's compromise offer to settle for certain tapes in return for keeping secret Nixon's status as an unindicted co-conspirator. Buzzard, St. Clair, and he were all involved in the May thing. The statement must make it clear that they were not aware that the president had turned down Jaworski's offer as a consequence of listening to the June 23rd tape. Buchanan and Price were outraged. They, and a lot of other people, had put their own reputations on the line defending the president and saying things that Nixon knew were false. Ziegler defended the president. Nixon had not listened until after the Supreme Court decision. They were wrong. He rushed off to check with his boss. Haig decided to do his own checking. He had Juwan call Wardell and have him consult the log from May 5th to be certain that that was the day St. Clair and he had heard Jaworski outline his proposal. Juwan returned a few minutes later. Affirmative.
Next, Haig picked up the phone to find those who could pinpoint the date the president listened to the tape, Bull, Shepard, and Buzzard.
He had reached the first two and was getting ready to call Buzzard when Ziegler returned. They fit together, for Ziegler, the pieces they had already found. Jaworski, Haig, and St. Clair met on May 5th. According to Bull and Shepard, the president listened to the tape on May 6th. The next day, the president instructed St. Clair to turn down the offer. Ziegler shouted that they were wrong. The president says he didn't listen to it then. It was late in May. They were all jumping to the wrong conclusion. Look, Ron, Buchanan said, his voice rising. We've got the records. The only date they were checked out was on May 6th. Here's the Jaworski thing at the same time. There's no other conclusion.
I don't believe that,
Ziegler said shrilly.
The president says it was the other way.
That the tape had been checked out was simply no proof that the president had actually listened to it, and even if he had not recognized its significance, Ziegler added. But he was all by himself on this one.
Haig didn't bother to dispute him. He called Buzzard at the White House. Had the president listened to the June 23rd conversation when he was reviewing the tapes? Which time, Buzzard asked, January or May? Either. Buzzard checked his own notes. They indicated that the president listened to the tape on May 6th, he said. Haig told him about the argument they were having and what Ziegler was claiming. Buzzard said that there was one other piece of information of crucial significance. Only 12 days ago, on July 24th, as Haig might recall, the president had specifically asked Buzzard to listen to the June 23, 1972 tape. There could be no doubt that the president had already heard the tape, otherwise he could not have singled it out as a potential problem. That was the clincher